From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we hear from a local champion for people with disabilities as he heads into retirement. Then we look at five community events happening in Milwaukee this month. We learn how one Milwaukee neighborhood is being creative to make more outdoor spaces.
There aren't a whole lot of public outdoor areas in the East Side Bid, so we just kind of looked around and I said, hey, there's this parking lot that's chronically underutilized.
Plus, new research from UW-Milwaukee could tell us if a beach is safe to swim or not.
Now the more I study the organism, the more I realize that if there's a lot more variance to it. It's found a lot more places than I would have thought, and that it's able to survive a lot better.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. 30 years ago this summer, the landscape slowly started to change for people with disabilities in the U.S. That change came through the passage of major legislation known as the Americans with Disabilities Act, or the ADA. The law helps people like Tim Okanowski, who has used a wheelchair for four decades. Okanowski worked with others who needed help and became the director of the Milwaukee County Office for Persons with Disabilities. He recently retired, but on his final day of work with Milwaukee County, he ended his career where it symbolically began, at Bradford Beach. Bradford is now ADA accessible. To talk more about how that was made possible and his career, Okanowski spoke with WUWM's Chuck Kornbach. He starts by explaining some key parts of the ADA.
When the law was originally passed, there were five titles, and each title addresses a different part of society. Title one was employment, so that employers over 50 employees have certain accommodation requirements, not only accommodating them, but dealing with some of the issues that they may have on a daily basis. Title two was state and local governments. Title three was public accommodations, which would be your private sector businesses and buildings and things like that. Title four was transportation. So mainline buses, over the road buses, trains, things like that. And title five was telecommunications. So the telephone system and 911 system, and how can we make that available to persons who are hearing impaired and deaf? And so that's where the universal access charge came from, and where the 711 service came from. That's a service to allow a person with a disability to call somebody who is deaf, and vice versa. Somebody who is deaf can call into the relay service and talk to somebody who's hearing just fine.
You mentioned quite a list there. In the Milwaukee area, what are you proudest of?
In the Milwaukee area, we've done a fantastic job in Milwaukee, both with Milwaukee County government and Milwaukee city government, at making our elected officials' buildings, government official buildings, accessible so that individuals with disabilities are able to access their government. That's been fantastic. And there's been some great progress as well in public accommodations. I went to UWM in 1979 through 84. And the accessibility back then, and I went there as a person with a disability, compared to today, it's just unbelievable on campus today. But back then, it was a challenge because there wasn't really requirements or codes or anything like that. So Milwaukee's a great place to live if you're an individual with a disability.
Tell me a little bit more about the UWM campus back then. It was more difficult to even cross the street and get up on the curb. Is that right?
Yeah, when I actually went there, I was a wheelchair user, and I used a power wheelchair. And I had to have almost every single one of my classes for my 5 years I was there moved to a different building on the first floor because there were very few where an individual like myself could get in and get to that first floor. You couldn't go really too many other places. And so I had to do that. And then getting from one side of the campus on the east side, maybe all the way over to the chemistry building on the west side, there were no curb cuts at the time. So I would go down a sidewalk and find, you know, the driveway entrances and shoot across the street to the other driveway on the other side and zip around campus in order to get from one building to the other. And it was quite a challenge when you sometimes only had, you know, 10 minutes between class. So it was an interesting experience. And I kind of laugh now when people talk about how they complain about the accessibility and it being poor. They have no clue how beautiful and nice it is today compared to what it was prior to the ADA.
Maybe another familiar location or two around town. How would you compare downtown Milwaukee today to 35 years ago?
Well, again, you had the same issues with when it came to streets, but that's the only way you could get around. And when it came to businesses, you know, there were just a lot of businesses that didn't have access into their business. I mean, over the years, when I was working with Milwaukee County, you know, we'd hear from a restaurant and they'd call and ask about accessibility information because somebody would complain and they'd say, you know, we're really questioning why we should put a ramp in our restaurant because nobody in a wheelchair ever comes into our restaurant. Well, that's kind of because you don't have a ramp at your restaurant. So it's kind of a funny thing, but it's actually a true story.
The efforts at change continue. There was a recent event at Bradford Beach on your last day of work with the county, I believe. What was installed at Bradford Beach and why is it important?
Well, what happened at Bradford Beach was the completion of a 5-year project, and it was to make Bradford Beach accessible to everybody. And what it involved is, well, a significant amount of planning and fundraising because all the funds were raised privately and the taxpayers did not contribute to this at all. This was done by community-based efforts. And it includes right off of the sidewalk there on Lincoln Memorial Drive, a small little plaza of concrete plaza where an individual could pull off of the sidewalk and either use the long sloping ramp down to the sand, which attaches to a portable rubber heavy duty, what's called a Moby mat. And this mat leads all the way out to the water's edge. Or the individuals on the plaza, they can utilize a large stairwell to walk down into the sand. So even if an individual comes with somebody who is able-bodied, they can get to the sand whichever way is most convenient for them. And the reason we wanted to open up Bradford Beach is, you know, you look at all the wonderful parks we have in the Milwaukee County system. Bradford Beach is the crown jewel. I mean, how many people absolutely love to live on the water or live near the water? Well, there was a large population of people who couldn't access that water, but now they can. And between the Moby matting, the ramping, and the free use of beach wheelchairs, that combination of equipment and access, no other beach in this country offers that. So it's really cool to be a national leader in not only accessing the water, but providing equipment to people who can't afford a couple $1,000 beach wheelchair.
At the dedication event, which I attended, and obviously you were there, you talked about a connection with Bradford Beach of a very personal nature. Would you share a little bit of that again now, how it's affected your professional career?
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. Bradford Beach is kind of a special place for me in that when I was 17 years old, just a little over 42 years ago, I was on that beach and I was on a bicycle trip with my high school, Milwaukee Madison. And we were, it was a very hot day, and we were playing on the beach and had lunch that day, and everybody was throwing everybody else in, grabbing arms and legs and tossing people in. Well, I was on the track team and nobody could catch me. And I decided, you know, I'm going to run into the lake and just cool off myself. And so I ran in, dove head first into Lake Michigan, and my head hit the bottom and I broke my neck. And so after surgery and everything, I have a C5 spinal cord injury, which means I'm a quadriplegic, and I've used a wheelchair ever since. And that was a month before high school graduation. And after graduating high school in my hospital room, that next summer I started down at UWM, and I went to the university for 5 years and got my degree. And worked at an independent living center called SUSO, which is now Independence First, for 5 years. And then I got a job with Milwaukee County, and I've been serving the citizens there for over 30 years. And it was really kind of a neat thing for me to end my working career with Milwaukee County, making the very beach where my life changed. Making it accessible for persons like myself and others to get back on that beach.
I think it was said at the event that what happened to you was a reminder of how quickly lives can change. And that's a lesson for everyone, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, people with disabilities, that's a minority group. If you look at all of the protected classes that are minority groups, a person with a disability is a group that anybody can join at any time. And I don't wish bad things on anybody. You know, when I had my accident, I consider it a blessing because I was only, you know, 17 years old. And I was, I had my whole life ahead of me. And because of the disability and a change in my lifestyle, I was in high school and I wanted to graduate high school and go into the police aid program and be a police officer in the city of Milwaukee. Well, I couldn't do that. And based on my career choice, I met my future wife, who was now a wife of 33 years. And we have a son and a grandbaby, and it's been a fantastic life. And we always encourage everybody to always think about people with disabilities and incorporate them in your buildings and in your programs and services, because, you know, the baby boomers, of which I am one, are getting older, and younger people still getting in car accidents and diving accidents and boating accidents, and unfortunately have to say gunshot accidents, that are causing lots of permanent disabilities. And so it is a group that anybody can join at any time, and we should keep the good things in mind, like the opening of Bradford Beach and making businesses accessible, because, you know, people with disabilities are not going to go away.
Is there unfinished business in the Milwaukee area for people with disabilities?
Well, you know, the ADA is a never-ending burden, both for government and for public accommodations, which means you never stop improving. The law didn't require everything to be fixed at one time. It would be impossible. And that's why the ADA was designed to continue making things better. With Milwaukee County government, as you saw, we just made the beach accessible at Bradford Beach. Also this year, we're opening up a brand new accessible walkway at the Ware Nature Center. A few years ago, we opened up a boardwalk and a walkway at the Bernard Botanical Gardens. And the city of Milwaukee is making more of its buildings accessible on an ongoing basis. So there are a lot of things. When you think about Milwaukee, there's a lot of historical buildings. There's a lot of public buildings and private buildings. I don't know, as I would say, what's important, what's next to be done. But because there's an ongoing, burden, I shouldn't say burden, but that's how they use it, an ongoing obligation to improve accessibility, I expect Milwaukee County to continue to lead the way in opening up opportunities for everybody to live, work, and play.
Have you decided in your retirement, quote unquote, whether you will be active in the efforts with a nonprofit or as a volunteer?
I'm on the advisory board of the Ability Center, which was the organization that spearheaded the opening of Bradford Beach. They've also been heavily involved in buying equipment for Milwaukee County parks for people with disabilities to use. They bought hand cycles that are down at the Wheel Fund Rentals on Veterans Park. People with disabilities can use those hand cycles for free. And they also were involved with buying ice sleds for people to use at Red Arrow Park during the wintertime or at Wilson Park Ice Arena indoors from spring till fall. And so that not-for-profit, the Ability Center, I'll continue to be on their advisory board. And I have been asked by a couple of other organizations to join their board, but I told them to give me just a little bit of time with my family so we can do a little traveling. And I will be getting back into to helping, because that's just in my nature. I've loved it. That's why I went to work for Milwaukee County, is because I want to help make other people's lives better. So I may be retired from the county, but I'm not going away.
Tim Okanowski was the director of Milwaukee County Office for Persons with Disabilities for more than 30 years. He spoke to WUWM's Chuck Kornbach after his recent retirement. Coming up, Adam Carr from the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service joins us for our monthly conversation highlighting community events happening in the city. That's next on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers. Every month, Adam Carr from the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service joins us to talk about some of the community events happening in Milwaukee. Since the coronavirus pandemic began, that list has included a wide array of things, from virtual museum exhibits to Zoom events, and now some socially distanced in-person things to experience. Carr joins me now by Zoom. Adam Carr, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
I'm happy to be back for another month of five things.
So again, we're looking at a kind of a mix between things that are, you know, incredibly socially distanced to things that you can actually go to in person. And I believe this first event is something that you will be able to go to in person.
Absolutely. So Alice's Garden has been very careful about reopening during the pandemic and keeping anyone who visits there safe and taken care of. They've built a good routine, and they are inviting folks into the garden, which is an outdoor space. And it's between 20th and 21st on Garfield on Tuesdays and Thursdays throughout the month of August. They've also been doing this for July, but on Tuesday, they are doing their Urban Farm Artisan Market. So there's delicious food there. There's always at least two folks vending food, usually more, a wide variety of different kinds of food, so you can go hungry and get yourself a great meal. But then also artists, artisans, craft people, people that make things are there selling some of their wares, so you can browse. On Thursday, this is Alice's Garden. It's really the garden night. They're selling produce there on Thursday evenings. That includes, I think, a really special edition from 5:30 to 6:30. Every Thursday, Chike Johnson and Malkia Stampley Johnson, who are both phenomenal actors and a married couple, are reading children's stories. So there's food there. You can pick up produce, delicious stuff, fresh from the garden, both Alice's Garden and the Wellspring Organic Farm. And there's family-friendly activities such as the Children's Garden of Reading. There's labyrinth walks, which are great, and also delicious food as well.
So this next item has to do with more of the arts, which I think is something that people have really been missing during this pandemic, you know, going out, seeing the arts, engaging with that part of our community. Tell us a bit about this.
Yeah, it should be no surprise that creative people are finding ways to creatively share their work during the pandemic, even though they can't do it in person. Five Points Art Gallery and Studio is a remarkable space in the Harambe neighborhood. They have a gallery called This Is America, flowing from the Donald Glover song This Is America, where people challenge the idea of America through their art, black artists. And they have a wearable arts fashion show named The Stitching that's taking place on Saturday, August 15th from 7 to 9 p.m. That will be an online virtual fashion show. I'm really excited to see what's going to end up happening. There are 30 original designs by 20 artists of color, in their words, boldly demonstrating their stitching together of America and ingenuity as they've creatively converted 2D visual arts, found objects, and more into wearable couture. So I think there's going to be music, there's going to be all kinds of things that are part of this exhibit featuring some really great local talent. The list of artists is very long and is filled with people that I know and respect working in Milwaukee. So that is going to be a way, you know, you could have a night of really unique and kind of cutting edge culture in your own home, but emanating from our city.
Yeah, a way to engage with the arts while still staying safe.
For sure, yeah. You can, like, dress up and look cool like you would if you were going to the fashion show as well. But also you don't have to, which would be my choice.
So the next thing in our five things to do this month, I think it's something that's on the mind of a lot of parents at the moment. We're looking at a book bag drive.
Absolutely. And this one, you know, connects with a few different parts. There are parents and students out there that are thinking about back to school. There's also, you know, obviously this is going to be an unprecedented back to school. There's also an unprecedented situation of protests happening in the streets of Milwaukee. And one of the leaders on the 13th, Sedan Smith, the brother of Seville Smith, has every year since his brother passed, was killed, he has done a book bag drive marking the day. And in his words, he says that he wants to commemorate Seville's life with positivity instead of the unrest that follows. So this year he's planning to do it bigger than ever because it is in the midst of protests of which he's been an integral part. He's been out on the front lines on a daily basis. So Sedan Smith is holding, there's going to be lots of entertainment there as well, but they're doing a drive for bags, pencils, binders, calculators, anything else you could need as a student. And they're particularly thinking about those in need. So this book bag drive is taking place at Sherman Park from 2 p.m. to 7 p.m. on August 13th, which will be the fourth anniversary of Seville Smith and the Sherman Park unrest.
Yeah. Going back to food, I believe, not quite Alice's Garden food, but we're looking at a farmer's market still on the north side.
Absolutely. So Northwest Side Community Development Corporation, or for short, Northwest Side CDC, they do a lot of great work out on the further northwest-ish part of town. There's a lot of Northwest Side, but Northwest Side CDC has organized three outdoor pop-up farmers markets. And not only, I mean, for me, this is what's appealing to me about these. They're a place to get fresh and healthy food, but they're also being hosted at some really interesting sites. The first one is taking place on Tuesday, August 11th from 3:30 to 6:30 at the old A.O. Smith site. So the Century City 1 building, which is right on 3945 31st Street, kind of right off Capitol, and that big yellow building at Good City Brewing. So that's going to, I mean, to me, I think that's going to be an interesting way to kind of experience some of the contemporary landscape and kind of get maybe an inside view of these interesting places in Milwaukee. They're doing two subsequent ones, one at Ascension All Saints, and then the last one, that's on the August 18th and on the 25th. It's going to be at the West Basin of a project that MMSD has done. So essentially a new park-ish kind of thing that's there to soak up water. So part of it for me is that this is a great time of year to go and get yourself produce. But baked into this one also, the Northwestside CDC has kind of made through their three sites a tour of three interesting places within their neighborhoods.
Yeah. Well, and most of those are going to be largely outside, similar to Alice's garden.
Yeah, they will all be outside. And, you know, I should just point this out. Three of the events I've named so far are in-person events, and each of them, if you go and look at their Facebook events, are very careful to point out all the measures they're taking to make sure that the precautions are in place, that safety's in mind, that reminding all customers, actually, now this is just, it's going to be mandated soon, it feels like, we'll be required to wear masks, and spacing and everything else is going to be taken care of, so I feel pretty confident you can enter into any of these spaces feeling like everything, all the due diligence is being done.
Yeah. Well, and this last event is completely distanced because it's all digital.
Yeah, you don't have to go anywhere for this one. This one is the Liberation Sessions, an online civil rights history camp for youth. I was actually around two of my colleagues and friends, Dr. Robert Smith from Marquette University and Dr. Michael Carrier from Milwaukee School of Engineering. Really, I admire these guys as much as you could admire anyone. They're both phenomenal historians who have helped me and helped people, their students and the public and community, get their heads wrapped around how we got to where we are today. And that's really the point of this. They're doing an online civil rights history camp, really aiming at 12 to 15, so middle school, high school age, every day this week, so from the 3rd to the 7th, from 10 a.m. till noon. So actually happening right now, these daily camp sessions will introduce young people to ideas like emancipation, Reconstruction, Jim Crow laws, the long civil rights movement, the present day struggles against police brutality. So all of these topics, I think, if you're a family, actually, I bet these will be perfectly calibrated to the family learning together and maybe helping you make sense of some of these difficult conversations that have emerged in the past couple months of protests. So I think these liberation sessions, I anything that Robert Smith and Michael Carrier do, even if you don't have kids, I think are worth checking out. They're every day this week from 10 a.m. till noon. And if you look up Liberation Sessions on Facebook, you can sign up.
All right. Well, Adam Carr, thank you so much for joining us once again to share all of these events. And I look forward to talking in, oh gosh, it's already August, so September?
Yeah, it feels like every month the world's a different place. So we'll see what the world looks like in September. And I'm looking forward to talking to you then.
Adam Carr is the deputy editor for community engagement at the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. You can find more of our conversations with them about Milwaukee's Central City neighborhoods at WUWM.com. Lake Effect will return in just a moment on WUWM. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. As restaurants and businesses in Milwaukee are enforcing capacity limits, many have made use of their outdoor spaces. But what if your business is on a busy street with few options for sending your patrons outside? The East Side Business Improvement District is finding new ways to add extended outdoor seating for businesses and residents to use safely. An underutilized city-owned parking lot along North Avenue will transform into the East Side Art Lot to support local businesses and artists. To find out more about the project, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski is joined by Liz Brodeck, Executive Director of the East Side Business Improvement District.
Liz Brodeck, welcome to Lake Effect. Thank you for taking a few minutes to speak with me today.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
So what inspired the idea of transforming an underutilized parking lot on the East Side?
So basically, I had been talking to a couple friends of mine who are involved in the Murray Hill Neighborhood Association. And right at the start of the pandemic and when everything was closing, we kind of were like, gosh, wouldn't it be nice to have some additional seating, especially at the point, you know, at that point we were really limited to takeout and carry out. And we were like, you know, thinking there aren't a whole lot of public outdoor areas in the East Side Bid. And so we just kind of looked around and I said, hey, there's this parking lot that's chronically underutilized. I've never seen more than four cars there, especially as we were going through the Active Streets for Businesses program. And I was walking the street every day for multiple hours to look at the planter configurations and talk to business owners and everything. I just never saw that parking lot get used. At the same time, I knew that there was an AARP small dollar big impact grant available. And we kind of are like thinking, you know, this could be the start of something really amazing and be a really great spark and catalyst for the area. So when we applied for and got that funding, I had been talking intermittently with business owners about the idea and just kind of saying, hey, what do you think? Is this something that you think would be helpful that you would like to see? And everyone that we talked to was so supportive. And a lot of business owners kept stepping up to say, oh, I'd like to program this or I'd like to do a pop-up market there. So the support grew so naturally and organically that this, you know, just kind of seemed like the perfect time and place and circumstance to try something new and pull out all the stops for how do we support our businesses during all of this, especially restaurants that already have such a low margin. So this is a nice way to kind of keep people in the area, create some turnover for those restaurants and their seating and their outdoor dining and get them some more business, hopefully, too, as well as pay local artists in the process. So can't lose with that one.
And the East Side Business Improvement District is made up of businesses along North Avenue. So where exactly is the lot that we're talking about that is the focus of this project?
So the lot address is 1915 East North Avenue. It's right between Von Trier and Beans and Barley on the south side of the street. So kind of across from AT&T and the library, kind of like across from Kramer right there. So it's a nice little inset lot, has a very distinct entrance and exit, which is kind of nice, you know, in terms of crowd control and making sure the signage is available to people very prominently as they enter and exit. And yeah, so that's the spot.
Excellent. So pre-pandemic, we all think about and reflect upon those times as we're in a new reality. But the East Side is typically a very busy, popular place with a lot of businesses and restaurants. But previously, patrons relied on being inside of those establishments because there's a lot in one area. But what atmosphere does the East Side have now during the pandemic? And how do you hope this project tries to bring some of the previous feeling back?
So I think what we're seeing is just kind of a lot of places turning inside out. I mean, we're seeing an explosion of parklets, which is amazing. I mean, the Murray section of that includes Izzy Hops, Kawa, and now Tavolino, one of our newest additions in the district, has beautiful parklet out there. Hooligans with their sidewalk patio and now expanded parklet space. Hacienda and Snack Boys both have the bid helped create some parklets for five businesses that use some of our 92 planters to extend seating outside. So we're really seeing just a huge expansion of outdoor seating because people either can't be inside or don't want to be inside. And most of the business is taking place outside. So we're really just trying to kind of create a new space for more restaurants and businesses to come outside and be able to kind of use that space as works for them, you know.
And bids are geographically bound, whereas these owners of businesses choose to tax themselves an additional amount to help the area. So do you think that the nature of this association in part helped to launch this project with such wide support, even if these businesses are struggling and adapting daily during this time?
Oh, absolutely. The value of a bid, especially in this pandemic, really can't be overstated. I mean, the amount of support that we've been able to give our businesses and the collective action that we've been able to take because, you know, we have an organized group of people who are looking at, you know, doing the same thing and having and facilitating just people talking to each other about how to get this done has been absolutely huge. So, yeah, being able to have owners in contact and coordinate, I mean, even those parklets with the planters are such a great example. We had five businesses that really knew that they had to be in a domino effect to be able to get this done for everyone at a very specific time. So being able to do that, you know, the bid picked up the tab for moving the planters for some of the for some handicap ramps that go into those spaces, and now being able to, you know, as a 501c3 to facilitate the Eastside Art Lot expansion is huge. Individual businesses would have a much harder time coming together to accomplish some of these things than they do with an established organization that has, you know, a point person who can just say, these are the things that need to happen, and here are the people we need to talk to get these things done.
And while the premise of an art lot might be straightforward, what kinds of long-term needs do you need to consider and fund?
Two big issues that we talked about when we put this together are bathrooms and garbage and sanitation. And bathrooms we decided to forego because we don't have a license attached to it. It's not a food license or a beverage license. People are just welcome to come and bring what they have. And we didn't want to, we were a little worried about what that might encourage and how, you know, how long people would hang out and things like that. And we don't want it to be a huge congregating area, just kind of like somewhere where you can come and take, you know, a book or a cup of coffee or sandwich and just hang out for a little bit. And then garbage and sanitation. So we are working with our supplemental garbage pickup providers. We are going to have trash cans in the lot, and then working with them also on the sanitation of the tables to make sure that they are regularly sanitized, but also putting that on people who are coming to use that space, the same as really any park space, to make sure that they're cleaning up after themselves, they're practicing social distancing, wearing masks and all that.
And how does the Eastside Bid plan on bringing together the community, not just as the place for them to congregate, but with artists as well?
So we're bringing the artists, we're hiring artists right now. We have a call for artists out that's on our website, theeastside.org. So bringing basically artists together that way into, you know, very loose connections, because we obviously also want to be cognizant of the social distancing that happens even as people are painting. But in the long term, you know, what we're hoping for, especially with this crowdfunding campaign, if we surpass the goal that we've set, we want to bring in some very light programming, you know, some acoustic music. Basically being able to provide another way of having artists make, you know, at least a slight living, or like allow them to practice their craft while being paid for it, you know, in an environment right now that's really hard to do that. Like, we're not seeing as much live music or local art congregations. So this is, you know, at least our small part of being able to assist with that. And then if there are some other pop-up markets that businesses help to put on, then, you know, we're looking specifically at working with Waxwing and Beard and what that can look like for local artists who are already in those shops, and being able to give them some additional exposure as well. So all of this is kind of like there, we've got our baby steps that we're taking into being able to help as much as we see feasibly fit for this area at this time.
How would you describe what makes the Eastside so special? And do you see it changing in the long term, or are you guys adapting like all of us to keep what you think is special out there, even though we have to be distanced and indoors most of the time?
There's so much that makes the Eastside so special. And to me, I think it's always about people. And, you know, we have such amazing operators, especially right now. What's kind of interesting is we have a lot of new bars and restaurants in operation right now, a lot of new stores that have come in the just even the past 2-3 years or so. And I think seeing all of that innovation, I mean, we have places that have opened during a pandemic, which is kind of like, you really have to be innovative and thoughtful and creative to get through all of that. And I think that's one of the things that's made the Eastside so special for decades and honestly generations. You know, we've been home to a lot of Milwaukee's firsts or onlys, and I think that we're still continuing to see that right now. And I think, like I said, the innovative spirit of everyone there has just been phenomenal. I mean, whether like we're seeing partners, you know, before Beard had a had their own website, they were partnering with the Waxwing to get their goods out and sold, so that, you know, we're seeing that cooperation there. Tavolino was partnering with Izzy Hops on the kitchen use and getting that food menu out and being able to debut that before they were actually able to open their doors. And I think that part of that cooperation is so beautiful too, because it's not always that you see businesses working together to promote each other. But we've seen so much of that. And it's not just because of the pandemic. You know, we just have really, really good people in our district right now and very responsible operators. Everywhere that you go is socially distanced, and we're seeing the best practices shared between everyone too, which I think is another reason that we're as worried as we could be right now, and of course are, because we don't know how long this is going to happen, but knowing or to go on for, But knowing that we have people who have each other's backs and who want to see each other succeed is, you know, you can't ask for more than that.
Well, Liz Brodeck, thank you very much.
Of course, thank you.
Liz Brodeck is the executive director of the Eastside Business Improvement District. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski about the Eastside Art Law. The call for artists who want to participate will be open until August 6th. We'll take one last break, then learn about new research on E. coli levels at the beach. Lake Effect will continue in just a moment on 89.7 WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Joy Powers. Research at UW-Milwaukee is helping us learn how E. coli can impact beaches. Just last week, South Shore Beach was closed because of elevated levels of bacteria in the water that could make people sick. Natalie Rumble has spent a lot of time examining the sand along Lake Michigan. She became a PhD candidate in 2017 at UWM School of Freshwater Sciences, working alongside Sandra McClellan, a leader in E. coli research. Rumble has dug up a lot of new information about E. coli that could help better inform whether or not a beach should be closed for health concerns. WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Benz met Rumble at South Shore Beach to talk about her research.
So I would say at the beginning of my tenure at UWM, I had more of a simplistic view of E. coli. But now the more I study the organism, the more I realize that there's a lot more variance to it. It's found a lot more places than I would have thought, and that it's able to survive a lot better. So I'm getting to understand the survival a lot better from a genomic standpoint of view, which is really important.
Natalie, you were sampling beaches. You were taking samples and planting them in the sand and beaches. Is that right?
Yep.
Explain that process and why you took that approach.
Sure. So I was interested in determining if all E. coli were able to survive or if only certain strains were able to survive. So what I did was I took E. coli from human sewage, some isolated from bird feces, such as from gall.
How do you get that stuff?
So we actually collect gall poop, and then we isolate out the E. coli in the lab, so we grow it out, and then we have a nice culture straight from the animal gut. So we took these E. coli populations from different sources, put them in these little growth chambers, then buried them at the beach for a couple months. And doing this, we wanted to see if all these different types of E. coli were able to survive, or if only particular ones were able to survive. And we found that E. coli from all sources tested were able to survive, which was really interesting.
How did you decide how long you would plant them in the sand?
That's a good question, because when we started this experiment, we weren't really sure what we were going to find, which was part of the fun part. So we started off with just putting them out there for a couple weeks, and then we saw that they kept surviving, so we put them out for another couple weeks, and then eventually that turned into a couple months.
So there was a release in 2017, and it said, new UWM research could give you more days at the beach, it gives health officials more accurate tools when deciding whether to close beaches. So that work is still underway. I mean, that you're aiming in that direction, but there's still work to be done.
Yeah, exactly. So what we're doing is we're taking a genomic approach to understand why some E. coli are able to survive versus others. And once you're able to understand the genomics of survival, you're able to identify tools to be able to differentiate them. So you can take a sample of E. coli and determine, well, is this new E. coli? Is this old E. coli? Is this E. coli specifically pathogenic? Or is this a strain that's generally not going to hurt anybody?
Can you take us through a tutorial on genomics? When you're in your lab, what's the first thing that you're doing? And
sure. So what I did was I took these populations of E. coli and buried them in the sand. And then after I buried them for a while, I dug them up and then I re-isolated these bacteria. So I sequenced the genomes of all the bacteria that survived. And then I also sequenced all the genomes from the bacteria from the input of my experiment. And comparing the genetic contents of the input and the survivors allows me to see if any genes are associated with the survivors. And did all the survivors all contain one specific gene that would allow them to survive versus some of the strains that weren't able to survive?
Clearly, when it comes to managing a beach or a family taking their children to the beach, knowing as much as they can that it's going to be safe if they're, you know, playing in the sand, if they're in the water. You know, what have you learned through the process? How far has the science come now?
So right now, when they do beach monitoring, they take a sample of water and they just tell you how much E. coli is there. This doesn't really give you a lot of background information of where that E. coli came from, or if this is E. coli from recent fecal pollution, and that this, or if this water is really contaminated, or if it's just E. coli that are long survivors living in the beach. My work is kind of trying to pick apart how to identify these long-term survivors to try to improve those monitoring methods. So right now it's kind of a black or white method where it's either yes or no closed, where we're trying to get more detail into why are the E. coli there, where did they come from? So then if we understand why the E. coli is there, we're able to come up with better remediation methods and better ways to protect the beaches and keep them clean.
So here we are in the, I don't know if we now say the middle of a pandemic or what we're calling it these days. Where were you in your research when this hit, and has it affected how you were able to complete your, you know, get your PhD under your belt?
I've been extremely fortunate with that. I already finished all of my field work for this experiment largely. And that when this all started, I was actually at my data analysis part. So it's been really conducive to thesis writing and data analysis, actually, this pandemic, because it's a lot of just sitting in front of a computer, kind of isolated, working through all the problems till you figure them out. So I've been really lucky with my timing of things.
What will you take away from this, do you think, Natalie, besides your contribution to the science?
I'd say I've learned a lot of varied skills throughout my PhD process. One particular thing, Sandra was on sabbatical for a year, and that really forced me to learn how to clearly communicate through email, because she was in Australia on the other side of the world. So a lot of our communication at times would be through email. So those times really taught me how to be really clear and concise in what I'm asking, which could be kind of tricky in science, because not everything's so clear cut and simple. But also, the PhD process has also taught me a lot about resiliency. You're definitely going to fail a lot when you start a PhD. It's part of discovering the unknown, is that not everything's going to be an easy answer. And if it was an easy answer, people would already know the answer to the question you're asking. So PhD has really taught me a lot about resiliency and about just keep going.
Do you think that science is on the verge of cracking this particular issue around E. coli, meaning identifying, knowing when to close beaches, but more importantly, as you said, to, you know, we can't control our environment, but, you know, what we can do to manage what's out there?
That's a great point. We can't control our environment, but this research, what I'm doing, it will help us understand what's going on in the environment more, give us a more complete picture of how these E. coli are fitting into the ecosystem. Because usually we use E. coli as detection of something that's not part of the ecosystem. But this work is able to pull apart and see if there's some pollution or if it's just regular part of the ecosystem.
Natalie Rumbol is a PhD candidate at UW-Milwaukee's School of Freshwater Sciences. She's focusing her thesis on E. coli, and she spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter, Susan Bentz. Milwaukee's empty storefronts and alleys have become a lot more colorful since the protests over police brutality began. Artists have been putting up murals all around the city. The work is a tangible expression of the energy behind these demonstrations. But as essayist Barbara Miner found out, you might miss them if you're not looking in the right places. She talks about her own discoveries in her essay, Milwaukee's Alleys, A Hidden Treasure.
I remember the first time I was fascinated by an alley. I was about 7 or 8 years old, and it was the alley at my Aunt Dorothy's house on Van Buren Street. My family lived in Wauwatosa, with nice big yards, but none of the urban grit of homes near downtown Milwaukee. There was something forbidden, and therefore enticing, about that alley. I remember my Aunt Dorothy sending my brother and me into the yard to play, but making it clear to stay away from the alley. Which, of course, made me want to climb over the fence and run down that alley. Instead, I usually settled for a quick jump up and a glance, knowing that before long my Aunt Dorothy would yell out from the kitchen window and tell me to stop. For several years, I lived along an alley in the River West neighborhood. I fell in love with the sheer practicality of my alley, the garage, the garbage cans, the electrical transformers and telephone poles, all conveniently placed out of sight. For the last 25 years, I've lived without an alley or a garage, but with the benefit that our yard is unusually big for River West. I spend much of the winter waiting for the warmer weather so I can sit outside, coffee in hand, and read my newspaper. Until recently, I didn't think too much about my neighborhood's alleys. I'd become used to walking along the sidewalk. But then COVID-19 struck. My morning walks with my husband became a lifeline to sanity. And as much as I love my neighborhood, it got a bit boring to walk up and down the same streets. One day, on a whim, we decided to walk down the alley instead of the sidewalk. A neighborhood I thought I knew like the back of my hand took on fascinating and unexpected complexities. Among other things, I'd forgotten how many smaller second homes were built on the alley end of a lot. And who knew there were so many types of fences separating backyards and alleys? Chain-link fences, wooden fences 5 feet high, wooden fences 3 feet high, lanternstone fences, cinder block fences. The occasional basketball hoop or elaborate garden, meanwhile, spoke to the long tradition of alleys as a second backyard. And yes, there were lots of electric and gas meters, garbage and recycling cans. My husband and I even took to counting the meters in order to figure out how many units there might be in an exceptionally large rental property. It was the early days of the COVID-19 shutdown, and we were bored. More recently, as part of the outrage following the killing of George Floyd, alleys have become home to socially conscious public art. Just off Locust and Holton Avenue, for instance, a once drab alleyway has been transformed into a multicolored homage to Black resistance and freedom fighters. Alleys, it turns out, have long been a standing feature of cities dating back to the Middle Ages. In the United States, they're mostly found in older cities. With the growth of the car culture, suburban developments opted for so-called front-loaded garages as a way to proudly display that one could afford a beautiful building merely for one's car. In Milwaukee, alleys have been a part of the city since its founding charter in 1846, when alleys were used for barns for horses and carriages, and in commercial areas for deliveries. According to the Encyclopedia of Milwaukee, to this day, the city maintains about 400 miles of alleys. Next time your sense of adventure is thwarted by COVID-19, don't worry. You don't need to travel far away to explore a new world. Just find a Milwaukee alley.
Barbara Miner is a writer, photographer, and producer. You can find more of her work at WUWM.com. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.